Before we get rolling, just a quick note that while there are no mature themes or topics in this episode, we do have adults being adults, so not all the language is kid or grandma friendly.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Hello, world! Welcome to Living to Write, where we talk with notable writers about their methods, journeys, and advice for other writers. I'm Brian Landwehr. I'm a writer, and if you are too, or just want to learn more about writers and how and why they do what they do, you're in the right place. And with me each episode is fellow troublemaker Bailey Patterson, who is both a talented writer and producer of this nerdy little podcast. Hello over there, Bailey.
Oh, well, dialectic salutations, my fellow troublemaker.
Oh, dialectic salutations. I'm sure that somebody in our audience is going to recognize it, or you wouldn't be saying it. All right. Regarding this episode, I'm not sure where to start or stop describing our guest. I just have this feeling that we're not going to have enough time with her, because her life, both professionally and otherwise, is really colorful and fascinating. She's a memoirist, playwright, television writer, producer, Emmy-winning showrunner, and so much more. So she's kind of a big deal, which I suppose makes you kind of a big deal for getting her here today, Bailey. So I'll leave it to you to tell everyone who we'll be talking with today.
I'm so excited about our guest today. She took such an unusual path into the TV world, and her path is genuinely worth talking about. Our guest today is Rachel Schuchert. She's a writer and she's a showrunner. Really excited to talk about the craft, The Room, and just what it actually looks like to build a career in TV writing.
Well, yeah. And when I said she's kind of a big deal, she pursued stage acting before she became a playwright. And then she wrote two critically acclaimed memoirs while she was still in her 20s. Then she authored a series of YA novels set in the golden age of Hollywood. And her writing has appeared in Salon and McSweeney's and Slate and The Daily Beast and Hebe and Nerve. She's been featured on NPR. She was creator and showrunner of The Babysitter's Club on Netflix, executive producer on The Handmaid's Tale, writer and supervising producer on Glow, and she's worked on a bunch of other shows as well. So I'm just going to go ahead and apologize in advance to you and to myself and to our audience for all the things we won't end up discussing with her, because I already get the sense that we're going to need to have her back again, at least once.
I think so.
For her sake, I think she'll be glad that we only have her for a limited time today. So let's not waste any more of this episode and get her in here. What do you think?
Let's do it.
Perfect. Dear listeners, we now give you Rachel Schuchert.
Lights, camera, action.
Rachel!
Hi!
Hi, Rachel.
So happy you could take some time to join us today.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, we've given our listeners a brief little sketch of kind of who you are and what you're about, so they have some idea of your projects, past and current. We have a lot of writers in our audience who are largely emerging writers, but it varies. Interested in all sorts of aspects of what you're up to, including your show running and all that, but especially the writing part. So I would love to start with a question that is either the simplest question you've ever been asked or or brutal. This is a Rorschach test for you. Why are you a writer? Why?
It's both of those.
Excellent.
I feel like excellent. It's both very complicated and very simple. I will say I resisted being a writer for a really long time.
Ooh, resisted. Okay.
I mean, from the time that I was like a little kid, honestly, like I loved making up stories. I would tell them to myself all the time. I would kind of like walk. I always had sort of like a parallel track of the story I was telling myself in my head as I was going through my day-to-day life. Like it looks like I'm like walking down the hallway at school, but really in my head, I was doing something totally different. And I had all these sort of alternate identities for myself. Like, oh, I'll do the princess story today, or I'll do the detective story.
I love that.
Kind of in my head. I also always would play this game from the time I was about 8 or 9 years old, where I used to, this is very funny. I used to cut out all these like people from catalogs, like different, you know, just, you know, you get like the Land's End catalog or the Spiegel catalog or whatever.
Sure, sure.
So you got all these like people that were all like about the same size. And I would cut out all these people and I put them into like family groups. And then I kept them all in these little envelopes that were sort of labeled with like their family and all these like biographical details about the people in this envelope. And then I would take them out and just sort of stare at them and come up with these like very complicated stories about the families and, you know, the divorces and affairs, sort of this like ongoing soap opera with my catalog people.
Wow. So you were always going to become either an artist or a serial killer then, apparently.
Something like that. Yeah, something like that. So, and I don't think I realized at the time that what I was doing with, you know, my catalog people and in my head was I was creating these kind of serialized television shows.
Sure, sure.
But the thought of actually like sitting down and writing them down just seemed like a lot of work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which I didn't like. I was a very kind of mildly sort of ADD kind of kid. It was hard for me to kind of sit in one place and like really,
familiar.
Yeah. So I struggled with schoolwork and things like that. Anything that felt like kind of homework was really hard for me.
Oh yeah.
So I really was like, well, maybe I'll be an actor, you know, and like, and so I went to school for acting. I loved doing plays because you were like, it was collaborative that you weren't by your, I didn't like being by myself. That was a big part of it too. I think It turned out that in television writing, you don't have to be by yourself all the time because you can be in a writer's room with all these other people. But I didn't know this as a child in Nebraska. You know?
Sure.
Like my vision of being a writer was that you were by yourself a lot, all alone in a room doing homework, which it is also that, obviously.
Absolutely.
But so I went to college for acting. And then as I was kind of studying acting, I started to like write things, you know, for myself to perform or like with other people. You know, it was a lot of kind of that, like you get a bunch of people in a room and you make something that sort of devised theater kind of world. And I think at some time in that period, it sort of started to shift for me where actually writing these things down in a way that other people could read them didn't feel that overwhelming. So I guess my answer is that, and I liked the control of it. I liked the fact that like, you didn't have to wait for someone else to cast you to get to do it. You know, you could just, all you needed was like a notebook really or a computer. So that I guess is my answer is that I kind of was always a writer, but then I came to terms with it.
Yeah. You formalized it along the way. Sure,
I formalized it. Yeah, and then it was like, okay, this is actually something I can get my head around doing. Also, I don't really know how to do anything else, which I think is probably a commonality of a lot of the writers that you talk to.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's always in there somewhere. Absolutely.
Yes, exactly.
So how did you get from the inspiration to do some writing along with your theater work to making an actual profession of it?
Well, you know, it was kind of an unusual, well, not unusual, but it was not, I didn't quite have the typical path. So
what I've seen, the order, yeah. The order was unusual for you.
The order was a little unusual.
Yeah. To put it gently. Yeah.
Yes. I didn't come to LA. I wasn't sort of on the like assistant working your way up kind of track a little bit, but like not really. One thing about me, no one in my entire life at any point in my career or life has ever suggested that I would be good being someone's assistant or intern or helping them in any kind of organizational capacity, which is like very clear to everyone that met me from the time I was about 7 years old. It's like, that is not going to work for you. there's things I just can't do.
Sure. It's good to know yourself. Yeah.
Yeah. So I'm glad that there was a different way into this for me. Cause I would have been immediately fired.
Sure.
But
sure.
So I started sort of writing for real kind of in college, and especially after college. I'd spent some time in Europe, and I was very lonely because I was just in like a foreign city where I didn't really know a lot of people. And this was not a time where you could keep yourself company with your phone, you know?
Well, I am reading Everything Is Going to Be Great right now. Oh, so I know a little of what you speak.
You do.
My goodness. Yes.
So I think that was really kind of about the time that I really started to write more seriously, like in a maybe vocational kind of way. And I also started to kind of write in that time in this sort of early internet where you could write these personal essays about things that were happening in your life. So I think I also started to like kind of seek out these experiences in order to have something to write about for, you know, all these kind of websites and things. And I was sort of making a living that way, like a sort of meager living.
Sure.
But I also was, you know, starting to write plays and kind of do them in New York. And that was also part of, so I had these kind of two paths that kind of wound up converging in television because we were reading Everything Is Going to Be Great. That was optioned. And I started to develop it for TV with the production company. I don't know if it was even formally optioned, but it was definitely like, I got a lot of meetings off of that book. It was sort of like an entree into like kind of understanding what it meant to like work in television, kind of how the business worked, you know, the pods, the studios, like all of that kind of stuff that, you know, you have to sort of learn and figure out and like what the process of, you know, selling a pilot, pitching a show, like getting, you know, all of that kind of stuff. I feel like I kind of learned through my journey with that book. But at the same time, all of my playwright friends in New York that I had kind of come up with were starting to get jobs staffing on television. You know, it was kind of that boom of this sort of, you know, 2010 kind of on where all these people with sort of non-traditional paths were like coming out to LA and getting staffed on things. And so those two things kind of really dovetailed for me in that I was starting to have all these meetings off the book and meet all these producers. But at the same time, I was like, wait, maybe I could like, I wound up with sort of representation across the board. And I was like, maybe I could do that too. And, you know, and I was like, great, let us know when you move to LA, you know?
Sure.
I feel like that has also really changed. It's like everything is so much more sort of far flung now. And I don't know that there's this, the same kind of like centrality of where you need to be. But, it was still pilot season in those days, you know, it was still kind of, right?
Like, things still had a predictable pattern.
Though. Things had a predictable pattern. Yeah. There were sort of cycles and schedules. And you're like, well, if I'm out in LA in January, I could take meetings on, you know, it was just that kind of thing. So it all kind of came together that way. You know, I moved to LA in like 2013. I didn't have a job right away, but there were sort of prospects. Like I had another book that was formally optioned and was in development. And they very kindly kind of let me be a part of that as the author, even though I wasn't writing the script. But I got to go to all the kind of story meetings and things, which was really like a huge kind of, it was like a lovely thing to do. And I think I understood the generosity of it at the time, but not totally, you know, like,
sure.
Like in that way that like things happen and you're like, you know, at the time, it's not that I was ungrateful, but I didn't understand that this was like an extraordinary thing to be allowed to do.
Interesting. And was this other book we're talking about, is this memoir again?
No, this was a YA novel I wrote called Starstruck that was sort of set in Hollywood in the 1930s. And it was optioned by Lakeshore Entertainment. So Gary Lucchese was producing it. And he was so lovely and such a like helpful, you know, we would meet, he would kind of tell me, like, he was very, very like helpful person to me in that. And they brought in, Chuck Pratt, who was going to write the pilot. And it was incredible that they just like kind of let me come to the meetings and sit there and like kind of weigh in on how I felt about it. And it really kind of taught me like, oh, I see how this works. I see like how you kind of adapt something. I see like how, you know, people kind of position it. Like it was incredibly helpful. And that was once I had moved to LA, and then I got my first staff job kind of that spring. So I had been in LA for maybe like 5 or 6 months and I got staffed on a show. And then I've just been sort of, here since then.
And you were happy to be staffed. Well, it's nice to have a job, but also not alone in that room.
Yeah, I was very happy to be staffed. It was really like, but it was also really eye-opening about like the process of it all, like the sort of hierarchy of the writers. I mean, it was a very traditional like network television kind of room. And so I don't know what I was expecting, but it was different. You know, not bad, just different. Like, and it was the first time I felt like I'd ever really been in like a truly, I mean, theater is a professional setting, like to an extent, but like,
sure,
you know, that you really have to show up at the same place at the same time every day. Like, you know, it's like an office. It was a different kind of world for me.
So what was the most surprising aspect of being staffed in a room?
I mean, I think the pace of it was really like that sort of grueling network television pace was really both terrifying and incredibly useful to have experienced that, like, you have to make decisions very fast. Everything's kind of happening at the same time. That was also, I was on this show, Red Band Society, and it wasn't like a smooth process. So it was also like kind of very informative to see all the things that could kind of go wrong, like all the sort of tripwires, you know, like where there can be just internal conflicts, conflicts with the studio, conflicts with the network, things, you know, deadlines not getting met, like just all of those kinds of things, and seeing how that snowballs, like, was actually, in a weird way, I feel like I learned more from the difficulty of that process, even though I think everyone was really proud of the product ultimately. And, you know, it was like, but it was, I feel like I learned a lot from being in kind of a difficult situation that I may not have learned if I had been, like, you know, kind of just immediately in this, like, creative sort of utopia right away.
Oh, that makes complete sense to me. You can have good experiences, but you don't learn as much without friction.
Yes. Yes. The friction was very helpful. I think it also made the whole thing feel a little less, like a little more accessible, like in a funny way too, because it's just like, oh, this is really hard, and it's really hard for everybody. There's nobody that this is like an easy thing. It's just never an easy thing. And so because of that, I feel like I wound up at the start of my career being really unafraid of difficulty, which I think has served me well.
Oh, I love that, because I could see if you happened to step into an environment where everything was very slick and everybody seemed to know what they were doing and to know what to do at every moment of every day, you could be left feeling like an outsider for a long time.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's true. Or just really at sea when you were outside of that environment, right? Like, which I've seen happen to other people who kind of just, like, you know, won the jackpot with their first job. And then when they're kind of out of that, like, incredible, like, wonderful, nurturing environment, feel like they don't necessarily know how to pull themselves out again, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. That makes good sense to me. So how did you make it from there to the Babysitter's Club?
Well, I was on GLOW for the entire time. So that was kind of my big leap into, like, more of the sort of prestige kind of streaming space.
Gotcha.
On two network shows, and then I moved to GLOW, and that was just sort of like a dream. You know, I was working with some of my best friends. I was working with Jenji Kohan. Like, it was the show I loved. Like, everything about it was so great. And I feel like GLOW and the Babysitter's Club had a lot of shared DNA. You know, they were sort of both these groups of kind of women have this kind of project. They're all different. It's kind of this, like, ragtag gang that, like, comes together to create something. And so, and we were all, like, the age, all of the women in that room were of the age that we had read the Babysitter's Club. In fact, the characters, Dawn and Stacy on GLOW are named after Dawn and Stacy from the Babysitter's Club before I ever did anything to do with the Babysitter's Club.
That's amazing.
So there's a lot of shared, and there was a lot of shared DNA, I think, just kind of not really, like, tonally or subject matter wise, but just, like, the vibe, you know?
Well, yeah, that makes sense. Because when you started saying that they had something in common, I was thinking, what? But I see what you're saying about the women in the ragtag team. Sure.
And I just sort of thought, like, well, this GLOW is my dream job. I'm just going to kind of, it's going well. I'm just going to kind of park myself here and kind of get to the point where, like, I feel like I'm sort of senior enough that, like, my own show feels like a possibility. And that is kind of what happened. Although it happened a little sooner than I thought it would, which is when I got a phone call that the Babysitter's Club, you know, they were looking to develop it as a series. And my dear friend, Lucy Katata, who was working for Mike DeLuca at the time when he was still producer, they had the rights to it, and it had kind of all come together. And I was the last piece of the package. She called me and she was like, do you feel like you're ready to run a show? And when she called me, I had just had a baby like 4 weeks earlier.
Oh.
And she was I know. She was like, I know you just gave birth, but I didn't want to not call you. And I was like, no, I appreciate it. I knew they were talking to, you know, other people. It was a little bit open. And Lucia Aniello was direct. I think she was attached to directed already. Like, it was, everyone had kind of, like, come together around this thing at the same time. And I was like, yeah, no, I mean, I was obsessed with the Babysitter's Club. I knew all this stuff. She was like, great. Okay. I'm going to get you on the list for like a meeting and we'll have a phone call. And the phone call was like a few weeks later, I don't know, 2 or 3 weeks later. And I was on set for GLOW because I was already back at work, even though I had this like tiny, tiny newborn. And I cannot express to you how tired I was at this point in my life. Like I was doing things like driving off the lot with like my passenger side door open. Like I just like forgot to close the car door. Like I was like not in my right mind. Like, people have shown me photographs from that time and I'm like, I don't remember this. Like I don't remember being at this place. It was
you were barely a person.
I was barely a person.
But getting it done.
But I was working at a very high level.
Right.
So I completely forgot about this phone call. Like, right. Like it was like, I didn't have it. I had written it down someplace and then like lost the thing where I wrote it down. Like it was, you know, it was a messy time, but luckily I answered the phone. I was like, oh yeah, I'm supposed to have this phone call. And I remember going in this little, there was like this little cinder block closet off the side of the soundstage, what they had sort of put aside as like a pumping area for me when I didn't have the trailer. And it was so funny. It was just this like windowless block. Like you could like hold your arms out and touch both sides of it. Like no windows. And then in the saddest touch, someone to try to like cheer it up a little bit had like put up like a calendar with photos of like tropical islands, like sort of vacation destinations to look at, which it really felt like prison.
Why couldn't it at least been one of those pretty Apple Store looking pods like you get in the airport? Like something, right, that, something.
They didn't have those yet. Everyone was doing the best they could. Mostly I just wound up in my office and then I sort of gave up.
God.
I remember like staring at like this picture of like palm trees that was taped to the cinder block wall. And I found that even though I had no memory of like this time, I barely remembered my own name, but I had this encyclopedic memory of the Babysitter's Club, which had imprinted on my brain like before. So having done no preparation for this meeting, I somehow was just like, here's what I would do with it.
Wow.
And then I got the job. So, so you know, it took a, as these things always do, it takes a while. By the time we actually like took the show out to pitch it, I was much more kind of in my head again and settled and prepared. But we wound up selling the show. I think we sold the show. It was like, I guess it was like spring of 2018. And then, you know, then it takes forever, of course, to close the deal and make the deal. And there was nothing in place. So then I did another season of GLOW. And then we wound up in the room for that kind of spring of like 2019. So it took about a year to kind of get it up and running after selling it. I'm telling this for your listeners who are like sold things and are like, why is it taking so long for this to actually happen?
Oh, it's very, very wise and kind of you to share that because we have seen some of that recently. People that we've been in contact with through Story Summit are starting to get some traction and then they get worried because, oh, is this all falling apart? And in many cases, no, this is running at the speed it's supposed to run at.
It takes a really long time. It just does. I don't know. There's the one business affairs executive in Hollywood, I guess, that all the studios share who is skiing 364 days of the year.
That sounds about right.
I don't mean to denigrate BA, obviously.
No.
That would be stupid.
We would not be doing that.
But yeah, I just, these things can seem to really crawl along at a snail's pace.
So how did things go for you initially running a show for the first time? How quickly did you settle into being comfortable with that? Not feeling like a phony. Did you ever feel like a phony?
I mean, I like all the time, right?
Oh, everybody. Okay, good.
Yeah.
Right. We already covered you're an artist. Yeah. So of course you feel like a phony.
Totally. But I actually will say that it was a pretty smooth transition for me. I think I am so lucky, especially that I had spent a lot of time on set already. I had been in a lot of room experience and like very kind of in person, intense, like kind of in the middle of it room experience. I had a very clear sense of what the show should be. And I had executives and producers around me who were very supportive of what my vision of the show should be. So there wasn't like a lot of friction about like, what are we making? We think it should be this. We think it should be that. You know what I mean? Like I was very lucky in the process that way that I had these incredible producers and a lot of support. And Netflix also was incredibly supportive of the show and the vision of the show. So a lot of that stuff was a little bit out of the way for me. You know, I mean, it's always hard, right? There's always these like challenges. There's always, some of them are internal, some are external. But I found myself taking to showrunning, I think, honestly, pretty naturally. And I don't know why. I have a couple of hunches. I am really glad that I did not become a showrunner before I became a mother, because I feel like there is something about the way that your brain reorganizes itself when you have a baby that is very conducive to showrunning, because you have a lot of plates in the air all the time. You really have to kind of organize yourself into this triage of like what's bleeding, like what needs to be taken care of this second, what can wait an hour, what can wait till the end of the day, what can wait till the end of the week. Like, you just kind of, like, something about the way that you organize your workflow, whether it's with your baby or with your actual job, I found really useful. I also think, like, because I had this baby to take care of, I didn't find myself kind of spiraling out about small stuff in quite the same way, because it's like you do get like your sense of proportion changes, and the calmer and more confident you can stay as a showrunner, and just the better, like, you know.
I'm not a mother, and I don't think I ever will be, but
you never know.
But I assume you were in probably 24/7 triage mode regarding yes. every aspect of your everything. So yes. why not throw running a show in there too?
Why not?
Why not?
Why not?
Do that in your free time.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So it was, you know, so I found it like, I actually found like I felt very, like I was felt very in the zone, I think, that first season and the second, I mean, just in general, it really all came together in a nice way. You know, that's not to say that obviously there aren't challenges, but for whatever reason, that one really felt like a very kind of blessed first showrunning experience. And I think once you've done it, you know, you can do it.
Sure. So when you start doing that, so you're showrunner now, how much writing are you or aren't you doing? Are you doing?
I a ton of writing.
So, ton. Okay.
And I mean, I think as a showrunner, it's really important, if you want to give yourself a break at all, to put together a staff that can really write like strong drafts for you. And I definitely had that on my first staff. I thought about it really carefully. And you get lucky, you know, like I think everybody, you do your staffing meetings, you know, you kind of, I tried to hire a mix of people I knew and people I didn't know. So I felt like, you know, there'd be people who would kind of bring fresh perspectives to things, but I also could feel comfortable. You know, it wasn't like a room full of total strangers, which I think, you know, is also tricky, that you feel like you have to perform for these people who like don't know you.
Right.
But I, you know, I wrote 3 episodes of the first season. I wrote the pilot, obviously, and then I wrote the second episode. I mean, I always tend to do on a first season show, I'll usually write the first, second, and last as showrunner. And then, you know, you kind of obviously have to do passes on everything that comes in. But I also think like that was still kind of in the little bit of the sort of pre-COVID schedule area, where like it was very overwhelming that everything was kind of happening at the same time, but it was also helpful because you still had your writers, like when you were going into production, like you were getting kind of notes in real time. People weren't off the clock yet. You could like kind of talk, a draft would come in, I would do a pass, I would get the notes from the producers in the studio or the network. And mostly I could hand those notes over to the writer to do on their own draft. And then I would do another pass before it went to the studio. You know, like everyone was still like around. I think now that has sort of changed, where like you have the writers for this period of time and you kind of come up with this set of scripts, and a lot of the notes come after, then the showrunner is just kind of by themselves having to rewrite everything on their own, which is also really hard.
Oh,
I mean, I've been in that one, so I've been in that too.
Yeah.
but that one kind of was a little bit more of that old model, you know?
A sort of dorky question I have about Babysitter's Club is, did you ever seriously consider making it a period piece instead of putting it modern day? Because I noticed the very effective machinations so that they could still have a landline phone and they could still hand out flyers yeah. and do things like that. And it works. It works. But what was there consideration at some point, well, let's just put it in the period? Or from like a budgeting and practicality aspect, was it always going to be modern day?
I mean, I feel like we thought about it for like a second and then just decided that it should be modern day. You know, yeah. It was like the books weren't written as period pieces, right? The books were written. Yeah. So it felt like they were trying to, and I remember reading those books as a kid and I was like, oh, this is telling me like what to wear. This is like a cool outfit for now. This is like how to, you know, this is a cool movie now. And I kind of wanted it to be able to give that same thing to girls now, not like how to be a girl in the 80s and 90s, but like, you know, here's what would be a cool, here's the cool sweater to wear in 2020.
That's a really good point. If you want to speak to kids of today, I suppose it better be accessible to kids of today who are not fantasizing about what things were like in the late 80s or early 90s.
I mean, I think our goal for that always too was just to make it feel kind of timeless, you know, that it's sort of contemporary, but not in a way that feels like you couldn't watch it 5 years later or 10 years later. You know what I mean? It was to kind of exist in that the timelessness of adolescence, whatever year it was when you were that age.
Well, I think everything you did to make all those moving pieces still work, but in a modern setting, absolutely worked. There was just enough attention paid to it. And then you moved on and I'm like, ooh, that is slick.
Thank you. Well, I think a lot of the way we live now is a real challenge for storytelling on screen.
That everybody's like, got a phone.
Everyone's got a phone, right? There's no misunderstandings, but there's also like how many times a scene is two people talking to each other in person. Like how often does that happen anymore?
I know.
You know, it's like, I think kind of just being able to like acknowledge it, kind of set it and forget it really just feels like the way to go for me. And without having to kind of tie yourself in knots about like, I also think them being young helps, you know, it's like, not everyone wants to give their 12-year-old an iPhone, you know, like kids don't always have that much access to as much access to screens as I think we sort of think they do, you know, there are limits kind of so, and they still really want to be with other kids.
I sure hope that's true, because I think about how much time I spent with other kids, even though I'm kind of a loner, I still spent a lot of time with other loners, if that makes any sense. But that's social time together. Yeah, I hope that's still happening today. I'm sure it's not as much as I want it to be, but I hope it's more than I suspect it is.
It's not as much. I think that's exactly what it is. It's not as much as you want it to be, but it's more than you fear.
Good. Hey, I'll settle for that. Yeah. It's 2026. I'm going to take what I can get.
Totally. I also think that's a little bit what's aspirational about the show. And in the way that like television always exists in a slightly aspirational space, you know, it's like the aspiration of Sex and the City is that, especially in the early seasons, is that like these are women who like have time to have brunch together once a week, right? Which is like no one ever actually gets to have with their friends. It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it is aspirational, right? Like it's that kind of thing.
Yeah, that makes good sense. So are you writing as much now as you were back then, or has the balance continued to shift to more being in charge and less doing the writing? Or are you writing more than ever?
I mean, I feel like I'm writing more than ever.
Great.
I mean, right now I have a bunch of pilots I've been working on, which obviously like I'm writing. I think though, like I really do like to write, but I also really like to give other people a chance to write. Like I feel like I'm a very moderate kind of showrunner that way. Like if you write a draft for me that I don't have to do a word to, that, like that's amazing. Amazing. Thank you. What a gift.
You know? Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not one of those people that's like, I have to do everything. Like, do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, and I think that really, for me, feels like you as a showrunner are really in the pocket, right? That like you've really figured out how to communicate to your writers what you're looking for. Maybe they've brought something to the table that has changed. Like you've come closer to them a little bit. That to me is always the sign that a room is really cooking and like you've really gelled. But it doesn't always work that way, you know? And I think also the wild card in this process is that you always have this sort of you know, all the executives in the studio and the network and their priorities, which sometimes complement, you know, what's coming out of the room perfectly. And sometimes something happens and you have to change. I mean, I also feel like a lot of times it's not because anybody didn't do something that people like, but because, like, you know, suddenly you have way less money than you thought, you know, you lose a location, an actor drops out. Like there's just things that happen that are totally external to the creative process also that you have to be able to kind of constantly pivot and adapt around and write to. So I don't see a world where I, as a showrunner, get to the point where I never write, but you know, one can dream.
But would that really be your dream, to not write?
I don't know that I see myself as the kind of person who is just kind of overseeing a ton of shows. I mean, I love the idea of empowering writers and like giving them, you know, kind of being able to be the kind of person who's like, I think you're great and I think you have a great idea and I hope there's a way I can aid to make this happen for you. Like, I would love to do that. But I also feel like I will always kind of have something that's also kind of an expression of my own creativity, because I just think that's sort of how I process things.
When you put a room together, how, in whatever units, how inexperienced have your least experienced writers been? Are you effectively mentoring some people in the room, or are you getting people with more industry experience than that?
I have had people where it's their first staff job, and I just think that, like, they're great and they have the right voice for it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I do think that, like, voice is something it's hard to teach. I think you can learn everything else, right? Like, but I don't think that it's my job as a showrunner or a mentor to tell you what your voice is or how you should see things or what your perspective on the world or your work is, right? And like, so I feel like if the voice that comes through feels like it's a good match for the project, then that's great. And like, I can teach you the rest of it. You know, I can teach you how to break a story. I can teach you how to function in a room. I can teach you how to produce an episode. But I don't know that I can, like, I can teach you how to write better, but I don't think I can teach you how to write, you know what I mean?
Right. To me, that just feels a little like trying to teach somebody what person to be. Like, you are who you are, and things can be built atop that, and there are things that can be learned. But there are aspects to all art, in my mind, that are just about who do you happen to be?
Yeah. How do you see the world?
Yeah.
You know, I think that's very kind of immutable in certain ways.
Yep.
That said, I think it's very important to be open to new ideas and new perspectives and see how they kind of synthesize within you. You know, like I you don't want to repeat yourself or only be surrounded by people who think exactly the way you do. I think for me, putting a room together, I really try to think not just about who I like, but will they like each other? You know, like, it's a little bit like when you're figuring out who you want to invite to a dinner party, and you might invite all these interesting people, but they have nothing to say to each other. Like, you know, obviously you want, like, you know, some diverse experiences, and, you know, you want in a diverse room and people to bring different things to it. But I think the most successful rooms that I've been in, both that I've put together and just been a part of, are ones where I think the showrunner asked themselves how the writers they were hiring would be with each other, how they would relate to each other. Like, are they kind of, do they feel relationally compatible? Because ideally what you're going to do as a room is come together to create a voice that's unique to the show that would be different if any one of you was missing from that stew, right? Like, if you weren't in there, the flavor of the show would be different. And it's really larger than any of you individually. It's about, like, what is the voice of the show? That's what we are figuring out together. And I think that if you can kind of head off people that just don't know how to talk to each other at the beginning, that puts you a little ahead of the game. That said, like, I don't think you should only hire people who, you know, seem exactly like you or have exactly your background, or, you know, I think a lot of people kind of see that as a shortcut. And I think that can sometimes also cut you off at the knees a little bit, because no one's asking questions.
You know? Right. And also, haven't these people ever been in a romantic relationship? Because if you find somebody who's just like you, that's not going to work out. You need complimentary, not
exactly.
You don't want a clone.
Oh, you don't want a clone. That clone is boring. Yeah.
Right.
And I think also being in like a romantic relationship, you have to know that, like, you have to be okay with some conflict.
Yeah.
You know, like, it's.
And you'd better learn from it.
and you better learn from it. And that not, and that conflict can be really helpful. Not all conflict is personal. Not all conflict is mean, you know, that like, and I mean, the thing that I always say to writers and to myself is like, drama is conflict. Scenes are conflict. If we don't have any conflict as artists in the room together, there's no conflict in the thing that we're making. Like, it's okay to have conflict. It's okay to disagree. It's okay to not like something that someone else has brought in. You know, you want to be respectful, but that doesn't mean that you have to all kind of be of one mind all the time or be like afraid to express yourself. So I think that that's also, I think especially like, you know, we've all been living in this world for the last few years where, you know, I think people have sometimes sort of simplified conflict into just being problematic, like blanket problematic, which I don't think is super helpful for what we're doing. I think there's a way to, you know, kind of clash and have disagreements and differences of opinion in a way that, you know, gets you someplace better and is interesting, that doesn't have to feel like anybody's being picked up.
Yeah, I agree with you. I do feel like in the last few years, there's been some oversimplification of some of those sorts of concepts. And well, not to go too far down the rabbit hole, but there are too many people in the world who won't participate in something if it gives them any anxiety, for example. Right. And it's like, so we've said, well, anxiety is unacceptable. I respectfully disagree. Anxiety is something to be dealt with appropriately. But if you're going to live a life that's free of certain things that are challenging, well, there goes the friction we were talking about. And now what are you doing?
Exactly. I mean, in my experience, like, anxiety is a fact of life. It's like having hair. I have never experienced a day in my life that is totally free from anxiety of some sort. So I think that a big part of being able to, you know, kind of live with it is to just accept it. It's not something that has to be eschewed. It's not something to be afraid of. You don't have to be anxious about experiencing anxiety.
And in fact, do something with it. Be a writer.
Be a writer. I mean, I think also like figuring out a way that your anxiety, really understanding your anxiety is something like it expresses yourself in certain ways. It's often at the heart of what you're trying to get at, you know, like there's usually something about, you know, everyone's got anxiety that fixates on like particular things, right? Like if your anxiety is really about like your health, for example, like what's behind that? Like if your anxiety is about failure, like what's behind that? I think kind of examining it as like a facet of your personality that helps inform your voice and your perspective on the world can be really helpful. I also think sometimes your anxiety, just to expand on that, it uncovers what the thing is about. Like I often find, I don't know if you found this on stuff that you're writing, that the thing that is like the constant sticking point the question you're always sort of struggling to answer is often what the thing is actually about, you know? And I think anxiety is like that too, you know, that like, and you often start to sort of act out behavior that's like, everyone always says that as actors, you know, that like, I remember, you know, it's like production of Hamlet where like, you know, the guy who's playing Hamlet, like can't make any decisions about what he wants to do. And like the Gertrude is just trying to take care of all the other cast members and the Ophelia is kind of losing her mind. And like the Claudius guy has become a total asshole. Like, you know, often the unanswerable question is actually the question. And I think anxiety is like that too.
Wow, we went deep. I'm impressed by us. Speaking of anxiety, what are you working on right now that you can talk about?
I think I can talk about a lot of it. I have
great.
Right now I'm working on an adaptation of Summer Sisters by Judy Blum for Netflix as a series, which has been very exciting. I've gotten to work with Judy, which has been sort of a lifelong dream. And that's kind of in development and, you know, we're kind of getting that together. I'm working on another project that's a sort of limited series adaptation of the Rodgers and Hammerstein Cinderella, which is at Disney Plus right now, which has like a lovely experience also. It's a little bit of a turning inside out of the story. It's kind of about like the fairy godmother is kind of the protagonist of it, but it uses a lot of the same in a like a Wicked kind of way, you know, like,
ooh,
here's the part
I
of the
like
story
that.
You don't know. Yeah, but it's that's been very, very fun. And it has kind of like a kind of Princess Bride-y kind of tone, you know, like a little bit of that, which the original does too, actually. If you go back to it, it's sort of like it's got a little bit of a wink about the fairy tale of it all. And so that's been very fun. And then I have another series set up at Peacock that I'm working on right now that's called Listen for the Lie, which is an adaptation of this really fun kind of twisty mystery thriller. It's this young woman who's from this small town in Texas, and her best friend was murdered sort of some years before the story. And then she's kind of tried to put out her mind, but she was always, there's always kind of a cloud over her. Like, is she the one that did it? They never found the killer. And then this reporter starts like digging into it, and she's like, all right, I actually have to get to the bottom of my own story. And she doesn't really remember what happened. So it's like a fun kind of twisty mystery kind of thriller, but with like a little bit of like a voice, you know. It's like set in this kind of small town, you know. I would say it's sort of like in Texas, and it's got a little bit of that vibe. I would say it's sort of like if like Richard Linklater made Mayor of East Town, like what would that be like?
How's that for an elevator pitch? Damn. Yeah. I love that. So
yeah, those are kind of the top of the television pile right now. And then there's all sorts of other things that are in various stages of different things.
Well, Rachel, this has been lovely, but I'm really frustrated right now because selfishly, I feel like I could chat with you for another 4 or 5 hours.
Oh my God,
and I do have so many questions. Like, I mean, we've been here a while now, and I haven't let poor Bailey get a word in edgewise. So, Bailey, if you've got anything, man, don't let me stand in your
way. No, this has been just a fantastic conversation to just, you know, usually I jump in once in a while, Rachel, but it's been so fascinating to hear your process and your career. I hate for this question to sound kind of trite, but what would you say to emerging writers wanting to break into the television world?
Get themselves into a room.
Yeah, yeah. Brian and I always hear, you know, like, TV's overstuffed right now, and not as many things are being greenlit as before. So, obviously, nobody really knows anything. You can't believe everything you hear. But I just want to know from your perspective and your experience, what would you say to that writer that's listening right now that's really resonating with your story and wanting to overcome that anxiety and put themselves out there?
I mean, I don't think it's a trite question. I think it's a perennial question.
Okay.
I mean, I would say that I know that there's a lot of like sort of gloom and doom about the business right now. And it feels like there's a lot of uncertainty and a lot of contraction. And I would say that like, it's always kind of felt that way. Like, it's a hard industry. Like, you just have to know that. Like, do you know what I mean? And also like when things are really hard, like, in kind of all aspects of everything right now, it's like, well, what have you got to lose? Like, you only have one life. If this is really what you want to do, then like, I wouldn't, you know, talk yourself out of it. Like, I guess my advice in a more practical sense is to really just focus on like what you can control, right? Like, none of us can control where the industry is headed. None of us can control the business plans of various streamers or studios or their metrics or their buckets or all of these like things that like, you know, there's like a whole industry telling you about them, and nothing that you say or do is going to affect that in any way at any level of the industry. The most powerful people in this industry have no control over who's going to buy their company. You know what I mean? It's just kind of the way it is.
Right.
So if you really like focus on what do I want to say? Where do I see myself? What, like, I don't know. I keep watching that that clip of Jesse Jackson from Sesame Street from the 70s that is like going around since he died a couple days ago, where he's like, it's like 1972, and he's with all those little kids, and he just keeps saying, like, having them repeat, "I am somebody." You know,
I would just
say that to yourself. You are somebody. You have something to say. There's a reason that you wanted to do this. That's what you can control, right? That is what you can focus on. You can focus on making your script everything you want it to be. You can focus on, like, you know, being the kind of person that you are, that can work in this room, that can kind of put yourself forward as someone who should be hired. You know, like, I really think like that kind of authenticity is and confidence is what people pick up on. And so I wouldn't waste a lot of time like trying to figure out like who you should be. You already are who you should be.
I love that.
You know, and I think I also would say, like, don't forget to have fun. Like, don't forget to let this be fun. Like, it's the entertainment industry. It's supposed to entertain us. And that includes you.
Right.
Right. So, like, write things that get you excited. Write things that you would want to see. Write things that make you happy. You know, trust it when it's easy. Trust it when you have it feels like all right. Like, I just feel like if there's an idea you really have to talk yourself into, it's probably not the best idea for you. Like, just like listen to that voice, because I think it's already, you probably already have it all inside. And the rest of the stuff is not something that you really have a lot of control over.
That makes good sense to me. If you're in a position of somebody giving you some advice and you're like, well, I could try that. Oh, I already think that that's probably a bad idea. What you do can be outrageous, but make sure it's something that sounds right to you, feels right, speaks to you, or else you're never going to make it to the finish line. You never will.
And I wouldn't worry too much about like trying to, you know, kind of preempt what you think people are going to want from you or what they're looking for or what, you know, especially not at a beginning stage. Like what you need to do is really write a script that's yours, that's a calling card. Don't worry about like, oh, this is the kind of thing they're making or not making, or this is the, like, don't that those questions are completely premature. Those are for much, much later on.
Yes. And for God's sake, listeners, do not chase a trend. You'll be too late anyway. And just don't.
It's so true. It's just so don't. True. Yep. I know. And the things that really hit are the things that no one saw coming, you know?
Yeah. People say, well, they're just not doing Westerns right now. That does not mean you shouldn't write a Western. That doesn't mean that.
That Western is inside of you. That's absolutely what you need to write.
You could be the person that results in them wanting Westerns again. It could be you. Mm-hmm. So fucking do it.
Yeah. A great story is a great story.
Right. Right.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for your time today, Rachel.
This was so fun.
Been a blast. And I think our listeners are going to get a lot out of your advice. And I hope maybe possibly we could see you back here after some of the projects you're working on now have reached streaming.
It would be my pleasure, for sure.
Lovely. Thanks again, Rachel. I hope you have a wonderful rest of the day.
Bye-bye. You too. Bye, guys.
Well, okay. I was right when I guessed we'd need to try to get her back here again. I feel like we could just throw a dart at the map of the path that's gotten her where she is, and then just make a whole episode out of just that topic, if not a series of episodes. A fantastic, fantastic chat. I couldn't be happier about her giving us so much of her time.
Absolutely. It's one of those conversations where you walk away just wanting to go write something.
Yeah.
Which I think is the whole point, you know?
Yeah. It had that effect on me too. It's like, well, I want to be more like Rachel. And I suppose theoretically I can be in some respects. Which reminds me that I love the chat we had about being your authentic self. You can't learn to have a voice. Embrace the fact that you are you and that you have the worldview that you have, and then make something out of it was stellar advice. She's so honest and direct about that and about every aspect of her professional life and everything she's done that's gotten her here. And speaking of honest, if you are a person who loves an outrageous warts and all memoir with a really darkly comic sensibility, I can thoroughly recommend her 2010 memoir, Everything is Going to Be Great. Great title. I'm reading it right now, and wow, just wow. So if you haven't looked at that, Bailey, do please. You won't be sorry.
So that's why you aren't answering any of my text messages.
Okay. Oh, yeah. I've been busy reading. Yeah. I mean, you're important to me, buddy, but I got engrossed in Everything is Going to Be Great.
It makes sense.
And though we didn't get into it today, I do want to mention that her new The Burbs series is getting a lot of good buzz. It's inspired by the 1989 Tom Hanks movie, and you can find it on Peacock. I think, do I have it straight? They just released that very recently, right?
They did, yeah. And I believe Rachel's episode has been released as well. If I'm not mistaken, I believe she wrote episode 6.
Okay, I didn't know that specifically. Oh, very nice. Okay, well, I'm going to have to check that out.
Perfect. I'll put the link to everything in the show notes.
Perfect. Thank you. And with that, a big, big final thanks to our guest this episode, Rachel Schuchert. And thanks as well to Story Summit for making this podcast possible. To meet other writers, turbocharge your craft, and learn about career opportunities writers really care about, it really doesn't get any better than the generous people at Story Summit. Please take a moment to check them out now at storysummit.us. Thanks for listening, and until next time, keep writing. And if writing is your career goal, please keep in mind that you'll be told no more than anything else. But please don't give up, because all it takes is that one yes. I've been your host, Brian Landwehr. This episode produced by myself and Bailey Patterson, with the support of David Paul Kirkpatrick of Story Summit.
I hope to be a writer myself someday.
Original music by Kenton Edward.